Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Varsha.
And today is a Thursday, and you're getting both of us. So it's pretty great. So I went to the screening of Dinesh D'Souza's documentary, Death of a Nation. And it was one of the weirdest experiences of my entire life. It was a sad red carpet. Like, because they did a whole red carpet thing, and they had, like, you know, D and Z list celebrities there.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and Diamond and Silk were there.
Oh, my God.
Which was kind of surreal, because, you know, I heard so much about them during the Facebook testimony to Congress. And so it was just kind of weird to see them in person. And also Tommy Lahren was there, and I was legit excited because I like didn't know what to ask her first, but she is exactly how she is on TV.
Oh, that's horrible. See, the thing is, like, I can't tell if people like Tommy Lahren or Tammy or whatever her name is are like really that craven and ignorant,
right,
or they're doing it for the money. And so it's interesting to hear that you think she is really like that. That's interesting.
Yeah, she is. I asked all the women who I interviewed on the red carpet about Trump's comments about sexual assault and grabbing women by the pussy. And they all said, yeah, that was gross, but like, look at his actions. You know, Tommy Lahren was like, look at how he elevates women in his cabinet.
What?
And, you know, it's one of those things where I'm not super experienced at events like that. I do all of my interviews over the phone, or if they are in person. So it was good practice for me to sort of approach people who not just disagree with me, but have a completely separate understanding of reality.
Yeah.
It was a lot harder than I was expecting it to be to kind of like come back and like follow up with a question. And it just makes me respect, you know, like beat reporters even
more. And I also think the reason it's probably tough is like they probably have an answer for everything, because they've definitely heard this before, right? And so I was thinking about like, why hasn't anybody asked Dinesh D'Souza why David Duke supports the Republican Party? And he probably has some BS answer he's come up with.
Did you get the clip I sent you? I texted you a clip of his answer I recorded.
Oh my God, what did he say? I didn't get that.
He said that Democrats are the real racists and they support all ethnic nationalist movements except white nationalism. And so David Duke tried white nationalism with the Republican Party. I'm paraphrasing. I don't fucking know.
That doesn't make any sense.
It's
and
so
also
bad.
Like white nationalism isn't like a movement. It's white supremacy. He is a disgraced
thing.
Indians everywhere. Like, I truly just want to apologize to the South Asian community. I don't know her. Like, I do not want to be associated with her. Dinesh D'Souza and Ajit Pai are the worst. And then Seema Verma is like
right.
South Asian Cruella DeVille. Like, oh my God. I can't.
Yeah. So that was a very interesting experience. I actually didn't end up staying for the screening of the movie at the theater because I was like, I'm going to go get a big glass of wine right now. But I do have a screener and I do have a write-up. So look for that hopefully by the end of today or early tomorrow morning. So that should be
I'm very excited about that. I did not have an eventful week. I'm just basically finishing up my paper for this conference I have on Saturday.
I read your paper. It was really good.
Oh, thank you. So I'm very excited about the conference. I'm a little worried, but also excited.
So we're going to do a quick news block before we get into the interview. I had the pleasure to sit down with Marissa Kabas again. I spoke to her in January about her Hope Action Network and talked to her about her new project, Crush the Midterms, which is a tool that allows you to basically create a personalized plan based on how much time you have, where you live, what you are fighting for. And it's a super simple way to get kind of an accountability plan. And I mean, I also just really love talking to Marissa. She's very smart and very interesting. So that was great. We're going to do a quick news block. We're going to talk about what's going on at the border with those kids some more. This story is actually the most horrific I think we've covered to date. We're going to do a quick Trump GOP bullshit section with Michael Cohen and, of course, more Trump tweets. And then we're going to do a new section called Varsha Explains Things that Devin doesn't understand well enough to explain to you. And we're going to talk about tariffs a little bit. And then we're going to do a quick Hellion of the Week and get into that interview.
Okay. So, Devin, what is the latest story that's come out about Kids at the Border?
Well, so this story is about the government forcefully drugging the kids in their care. So there was a judge who found that the government has been forcibly giving kids medication without the consent of their parents or guardian. And I almost didn't believe this one at first. There was, I know that sounds ridiculous and completely bananas, but there was almost this part of me where I was like, that is a bridge too far. And it shouldn't surprise me. I mean, this is an administration that literally ripped kids away from their parents who were basically abducting children. So it would track that, of course, they would drug them to control them. That makes perfect sense. They don't see these kids as human. They don't see these kids as children that need to be taken care of. So it tracks. But this story, along with a couple of other stories that I've read about abuse in these centers, really kind of broke me in a way.
I just couldn't finish it. It took me like an hour to like go back and actually finish the story. Basically, it's at this Shiloh Residential Treatment Center in Manvel, and their staff members at this treatment center, they admitted to signing off on medications when they didn't have a parental or a guardian signing off on it for kids. And government officials are actually defending this. Like, I don't understand why you would defend this, but they go to the court and they defend this. And they're saying they provided these drugs only on a, quote, emergency basis. And only when the child was presenting extreme psychiatric symptoms and they became dangerous. And I'm just like, when is a child dangerous, like actually dangerous, that you need to force feed them medication? And I think if they were actually dangerous, you'd be able to get parental support.
There's a whole debate about medicating children outside, like in normal contexts, right? Which is a completely separate issue. But this also, they're saying it's on an emergency basis, but there were children testifying in court that they were given medication every morning and every night on an ongoing basis. That's not distributing emergency medication for a violent episode. And, you know, this Shiloh place has my name, my phone number, my address. They never even contacted me about it. They didn't even try. Because again, they don't see these kids as kids. They don't see them as human beings. They don't see them worthy of reaching out to a parent or guardian or advocate before doing something so heinous. So the judge ordered that they stop. This was a court case. The judge ordered that they stop doing this and that all of those kids were transferred out of Shiloh. Though this is not the only facility that is abusing children. And what's also horrible is that there's different types of facilities that are holding these kids that have been taken from their parents. So there's basically centers that serve to house the kids, but then there are more juvenile detention center type places that have lockdown that are structured more like prisons. And I can't get that image out of my head.
I really can't. It's just so incredible to believe that all across this country, we are literally locking up children who have not committed a crime at all. Right. The argument against juvenile detention is a totally separate argument when kids commit acts that are against the law. That's totally separate. And I'm against that. But again, separate. These are kids who have not done anything wrong. And it's not just like they were forcibly giving them medication, which is bad enough. There was a minor who his name is Julio, and he testified that Shiloh staff refused him and other children to leave the areas to get water. And he was abused and thrown to the ground when he tried to get water by a staff member. And so the judge literally had to order, which is the most 2018 horrific dystopian thing that you have to order. The judge had to order that Shiloh stop using unessential security measures, big air quotes around that, such as denying children drinking water. Then the judge, insisted that officials allow children to speak privately over the phone. They were denying phone calls to these kids. There was also another story in a separate issue where they were charging parents like $8 a minute to talk to their kids. So basically, we are not only like kidnapping children, separating from their parents, we are also monetizing that. It's the most dystopian thing I have ever heard.
I mean, as this story develops, it gets more and more horrific. But again, I was surprised, but I shouldn't have been. Again, this is the logical end that we were barreling towards. There's no way to take kids from their parents en masse without this sort of dystopian future being the logical conclusion. And there have been reports that kids have been sexually abused in these centers, that they've been harmed by the guards and the staff, that they've been harmed by each other, and now that they're being forced medication. This is what I mean when I say I fear for the soul of our nation above all else. Because I'm a Pollyanna pants, and I can have an innate belief in our democratic institutions. And assuming we don't collapse democracy in the next 2 years, I have real hope and real faith that we can reverse at least some of the damage done. But I don't know that we can reverse this. How do you come back from this? The other thing is, you don't, because we've done this before, because we have a history of slavery and we have a history of interning American citizens, our own citizens, in camps, and we have a history of genocide. And I don't think we've ever come back from that. You know, I'm just concerned that this is just going to add to that lexicon and never be repaired.
The level of messed up that this is, I can't even think of a proper word, is just so extreme. Because not only like is the Trump administration to blame for this specific type of policy, family separation, and the amount of abuse that has happened since the beginning of 2017 when his administration began, he actually had the audacity to tweet on July 30th, quote, "A highly respected federal judge today stated that the Trump administration gets great credit for reuniting illegal families. Thank you, and please look at the previous administration's record. Not good." No, no, you do not get to blame Obama for family separation. Obama had bad immigration policies in his first term. He could not get a handle of ICE, and that is a problem that has to do with ICE's structure and Obama's willingness to exercise political capital, but he did not forcibly separate parents from their children. The argument against family detention is a whole separate argument, and I am against it, as is probably every Democrat and every person who understands how horrific it is, but he didn't forcibly separate children from their parents. He didn't encourage the rounding up of people in the streets. He didn't encourage like getting rid of sanctuary cities. Like he is not on the level that Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump is. Right. But even the notion that Donald Trump should get credit from a federal judge for a policy he created is just bananas. He literally is the reason right. for this. Jeff Sessions was clear. We are going to separate you from your kids if you break the law. And by breaking the law, it's a misdemeanor. It's not even a felony.
The other thing about that tweet that really bothers me is that families are not illegal. People are not illegal. Yeah. That is absolutely incendiary rhetoric that just perpetuates this debate even further. A person can't be illegal. That's not how this works. A person can be undocumented, but they're not illegal. And I think that's really an important distinction to make. And again, at this screening that I went to, I asked everyone that I could about this family separation policy. And they all said, oh, it started back in the Clinton administration and Obama had bad policies and these kids have been returned. And it's like, yeah, you don't get credit for solving a problem that you fucking created. And to that end, they haven't returned all of the kids. They deemed 900 children ineligible to be returned to their parents.
Yep.
900 children. And the response to that was mind-bendingly whataboutism.
Yeah. Whataboutism is truly just the buzzword for the Trump administration. Whatever bad things happen, all they can say is what about something else or what about Obama? And like on the most extreme cases, when Trump is asked whether Kim Jong-un is a dictator or Vladimir Putin is a dictator, he'll say, what about America? We've murdered people too. And I'm like, yeah, that's bad. But Vladimir Putin is still a dictator. Like you understand that. And right. he doesn't, because this is how that kind of logic works. They can say, what about, which is literally what Vladimir Putin and other authoritarians do, and then they can escape the argument. But that's not how it happens. And right. it just gets worse, because he's not just using this for like political gain with his base, this family separation, because you better believe there's a section of his voters who actually support what ICE is doing, who like explicitly don't care whether families are being separated because they explicitly don't see them as families. He is now threatening a government shutdown over this, over the wall in the fall. His own party is in control, and he is threatening a shutdown. He literally tweeted, "I would be willing to shut down the government if Democrats do not give us the votes for border security, which includes the wall, and finally go to the system of immigration based on merit. We need great people coming into our country. If he really wanted immigration based on merit, he would have supported a DACA fix, because DACA is right. based on merit. It is based on the fact that, one, you came during a certain period and your parents brought you were under 18. Two, you have no criminal record. And three, you have to be achieving something. You're either joining the military, you're going to college, you're getting a job. You have to be eligible for it. And so it is based on merit. There are people who are right. rejected. It's not just a blanket, you know, status given to millions of people. So it's right. clear that he is racist. And it's clear that he is willing to sabotage Republicans' elections to do this.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's also going to be an important part of this moving forward, because these Republicans might not have spines, but I've said this before and I'll say it again. They like their power and they will do anything to keep it. And I'm hoping, though I'm not holding my breath, that that ruthlessness translates into defying some of these Trumpian bullshit things that are going to get them voted out of office. So that's what I'm really hoping. But actually, speaking of Trump tweets, I also want to talk about Trump tweeting about Jeff Sessions. He tweeted that Jeff Sessions needs to shut down the Mueller witch hunt. What's interesting about that is, one, Sessions has nothing to do with the Mueller investigation. He recused himself. Rod Rosenstein is in charge of that. And two, this really speaks to, I think, a panic. This is a Hail Mary panic attempt, because we've already seen in the last week the party line from the Trump administration and his surrogates like Giuliani has shifted from there's no collusion to collusion is not a crime. And so I think we see this as a signal that Trump himself is starting to panic, especially with the Michael Cohen tapes coming out, with Paul Manafort on trial. I feel like it's like that scene in Star Wars where the walls are crushing in on you. And I think that's what he's feeling.
I really agree, because he's been tweeting like an increasing amount about the trial recently, or about the Mueller investigation.
Right.
It's actually like disconcerting. I think he was up at like 1 a.m. last night tweeting Eastern time. So it was pretty weird.
Right.
But also, I just love how he literally tweeted out obstruction of justice. He said Attorney General Sessions should stop this rigged witch hunt right now. And everyone everyone who had a brain was like, hey, can he really order the Justice Department to do something? Isn't that like not allowed? And then Rudy Giuliani's like, no, it wasn't like, it was just like a suggestion. It wasn't like an actual order.
Okay, sure.
And it links to what we talked about on Monday, why, you know, Sessions is so eager to please with not just family separation, but also when he like shouts, lock her up. Like he wants to keep his job. It really is about power for him. He doesn't want to lose his job. I don't think, like, if you asked Sessions and you sat him down and you insisted that he tell the truth, I don't think he gives a crap about rule of law, the Mueller investigation, or election meddling. I think he probably had a teeny tiny role in election meddling when it came to what the campaign was doing with Russia, and he probably doesn't care. He just wants to continue to be attorney general to screw over brown people and their families.
Right. Yes. I mean, I feel like that's an interesting point, a correct point, is I think... This is going to sound, I cannot believe these words are coming out of my mouth in the year 2018, but I think Jeff Sessions cares more about being a racist than about election meddling. I think you're right. I think that he probably didn't know or didn't care during the election, and he really, his only aim was to create policies that basically dehumanize and remove civil liberties from people of color. I think that was it. That's the whole thing. That's the whole goal. That's the whole thesis. And so it would make perfect sense that he would recuse himself. Like Trump was like, if I had known, I wouldn't have hired him. And it's like, well, that's why he didn't fucking tell you, because he doesn't fucking care, because that's not his end goal. And when you have an end goal like that, it's not just cruelty. It's more than that. It's the manipulation of a system in order to hurt people. And I don't know, there's not necessarily a word for that. But again, no one really likes Holocaust comparisons, but like that was ultimately the goal of fascism in Germany. It wasn't even necessarily about political power. It was about using the system to hurt people.
And I really think there's a difference between people like Sessions and Miller who like enjoy this. And the director of ICE was doing an interview recently, and they played for him the ProPublica tape of that little girl crying and asking and begging to call her aunt. And he literally didn't give a crap. He was like, it tugs at the heartstrings, sure, but we have to have border security. I'm like, what do you mean? This child is preventing you from catching MS-13 gang members? Like, I don't know if the interviewer actually pushed him on this because it was just like a commercial reel for the interview. But I'm just like, I want them to take the next logical step in their argument. Because when right now, when the media questions them about this, or when we talk about this, like they only say that first line, that first rebuttal against you, they say, I guess that is bad. Like, I guess it's bad to separate kids from their parents, but we need laws in this country. I want them to go the next step further, where I would ask them, so you think if you commit a misdemeanor, you should be locked up, especially if you're under 18 forever with no chance of seeing your parents again? Does that make sense? If you commit a misdemeanor, you should be denied water. You should be forced to have medication that your parents don't want you to take, or that you probably don't want to take. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make logical sense that border security equates putting kids in baby jails. It really doesn't.
Right. And this goes back to Trump's frantic tweets that are really giving us insight into his sort of panic, because, you know, maybe his base likes these policies. In fact, I know his base likes these policies. But he's also feeling the squeeze from his bad acts are catching up with him. Michael Cohen is catching up with him. Paul Manafort is catching up with him. And I think that that's reflected in this sort of scramble to say, oh, collusion isn't a crime. Oh, this didn't really happen. Oh, I'm going to throw more red meat to my base because I'm worried. And so I think it's kind of a sign of his panic.
It's not just like Trump that's like twisting family separation to his own ends, not just to gain votes for his base and to be a racist. Ivanka Trump is doing the same thing. And like she was doing an interview with Axios. And like, I just want a disclaimer here, like Axios makes its money and succeeds because its business model is access journalism. So with that in mind, like they literally have rosy pictures of people they interview, which are usually Republicans, but sometimes Democrats. Like that is their business model. Access Axios. With that said, so Ivanka Trump said in an Axios interview about family separation, that was a low point for me as well. I feel very strongly about that, and I'm very vehemently against family separation and the separation of parents and children. Bullshit. Because then she goes on to say, I think immigration is an incredibly complex topic. And illegal immigration is incredibly complicated. What does that mean? That doesn't mean anything. That just is proof you don't understand it and you shouldn't be working for the White House.
Well, I was just going to say, yes, it's complicated. That's why we elect competent officials who understand the complexities and who have real solutions and who don't fucking post pictures of you and your son in this like cuddle when there are children being medicated in baby jails.
And then she uses her mother. She was like, I'm a daughter of an immigrant. My mother grew up in the communist Czech Republic, but we are a country of laws. She's literally like, you can see what her argument is. She is couching her sad story with her mother, which again is legitimately sad. Like it must have been really difficult for people who lived in the Czech Republic before the Soviet Union fell to come to the United States. But then she's using that to buttress, but we are a country of laws. She's not actually against family separation because she's literally saying this is the law. But clear, it's not a law. It is a policy created by Jeff Sessions, Stephen Miller, and Donald Trump.
All right, Varsha. So let's move on to our next section. Varsha explains. So can you explain what is going on with the tariffs / trade war / the They want to bail out farmers, basically. So can you kind of take us through that and tell us what's going on?
Yeah. So the first thing to remember is that trade wars are not great and they are not easy to win because they're literally a back and forth. So Trump, because his brain is stuck in the 1980s, thinks that the best way to get good trade deals for the United States is to have a protectionist trade agenda, which means levying tariffs against a bunch of other countries on their imports into the United States or their exports into the United States, because then he can buttress up U.S. manufacturing or U.S. markets, right?
Right. And actually, it was a Republican senator, Ben Sasse, who said protectionism is how we got the Great Depression.
Yes.
And basically was like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. Every high schooler knows about the Smoot-Hawley tariff. The Smoot-Hawley tariff is basically, in the 1920s and 1910s, we were super protectionist against Europe and the rest of the world. And so in response, Europe became super protectionist against us. And a really simple explanation for the Great Depression is that this kind of protectionist agenda made it more and more difficult to actually engage in proper trade, made it really difficult to get the proper goods that you needed, and, you know, eventually encouraged and didn't hurt the Depression. It didn't help us get out of the Depression, right? Tariffs are not good. It's stupider than like mercantilist ideology from the 16th century. Tariffs, free trade has been proven to be a good thing for economies. Right. Again, free trade is not perfect. If you have unlimited free trade, like no protection whatsoever, then you are going to hurt your own industries, which is why we don't have perfect free trade. NAFTA, even the TPP before it was gutted, before it was rejected by Trump and the World Trade Organization, like they allow for certain amounts of protection for home industries, but they also encourage an actual trade of goods. Trade is good. It's what lifts people out of poverty in certain countries. It's not perfect, but it is good. And you're allowed to protect against it, but you shouldn't be this extreme, right? So he, Trump, imposes tariffs on imported steel, aluminum, electronics. And so China, Mexico, and Canada and Mexico, who aren't our like enemies, like I can understand.
They're allies.
They're allies.
They're our closest ally.
Yeah. I can understand pressuring China because China does steal our intellectual property with tariffs. But the extent to which he is putting tariffs on China, Mexico, Canada, and the EU is bananas, because he's putting taxes on imported steel, aluminum, electronics. And so they respond with taxing American soybeans, dairy, pork, apples, potatoes, as well as a bunch of other U.S. products. So what that means,
including Harley Davidson's, which are made in Harley
Davidson's.
So fuck you, Paul Ryan.
And then Kentucky bourbon. Fuck you, Mitch McConnell. So like these countries know what they're doing because they're not morons like Trump. And so they're hurting Trump in Republican areas, especially farmers. So in response, what does Trump do? Does he lower the tariffs? No, that would be a logical response. He decides to use a depression as in 1930s era program, which allows the government to borrow up to $30 billion from the Treasury without congressional approval to bail out the farmers. I think that sounds like socialism to me. That sounds like Soviet era 5-year plans where they would literally bail out certain industries. They would nationalize certain industries in order to protect them from the crap that is going on in the world. Like it's moronic. And again, I am not like the craziest, most Adam Smith free trader you will find, but I'm also not in favor of intense protectionism. So I'm somewhere in the middle, like Obama, like Hillary Clinton, like most Democrats. And so I understand the need for protectionism. I understand the need for having America, quote unquote, win in its trade battles, which NAFTA does, by the way. But bailing out farmers with borrowed money isn't a long-term solution. It's not going to help anything.
So I have a question. Because there was also some speculation that other countries could make complaints to the World Trade Organization, because this is not what tariffs were built for. It was not supposed to be something where you create a protectionist society and then you use funds to basically bail out these industries. So basically you could make the argument that you are using tariffs and then using these subsidies on top of those tariffs to manipulate the global economy.
Yeah, that is one argument that could have been made. Also, like Trump wants to like, I think Trump or Peter Navarro, his trade advisor, wants to literally withdraw from the WTO, which would be horrific. But also the reason they would also go to the WTO is when they imposed tariffs on Canada, they claimed that it was because of Canada was a national security threat. And that's just not true. And also it's the same thing with China. They were claiming something really specific, and China was like, no, we can go to the WTO over this. Or I think the EU wanted to go to the WTO. Like they can all technically go to the WTO because the way that Trump is justifying these tariffs don't fit with the rules under the WTO. And again, like the U.S. might win that WTO challenge because the U.S. is like the biggest player in the WTO, but it's still supposed to follow the rules of the WTO.
Right.
But I think the real reason he's bailing out agriculture is because it's in Trump County. Like these soybean farmers are his voters, right? And again, like you can argue that these voters who are probably predominantly white voted for him, not because of quote economic anxiety or trade barriers, but because of racial status, but still they are being hurt by this. And overall the US economy is hurt.
Well, but interestingly, I've been reading interviews with these farmers and they're like, yeah, this isn't great. And I hope they figure this out. We don't want trade war. But like, I still like even knowing this, I still would have voted for Trump. Fuck you. It's not economic anxiety. It's not even economic self-interest. Like
it makes no sense.
You know, it's literally.
Also, this $12 billion bailout to farmers would actually help like the bigger agribusinesses. It wouldn't help these small-time farmers, right? The bigger businesses would get more of the money. Right. And so that's what just really bothers me. It's like an illogical policy choice. It's not going to help in the long term. It's responding to a crisis he created himself. Like if he could actually just sit down with leaders from these other countries and actually just go back to a normal trade policy, he could claim a victory, but he won't because his brain is stuck in the 1980s. But I guess what bothers me the most is senators like Ben Sasse, who are just like, this is dumb. Europe, Canada, and Mexico are not China, and you don't treat allies the same way you treat opponents. We've been down this road before, and he talks about how this caused the Great Depression, right? But that's all he does. There's no like attempt in right. the Senate to do anything. I just want to shout at Bob Corker and Jeff Flake and Ben Sasse, you are United States senators. You have constitutionally protected attempts to conduct oversight, to actually be a part of this process. You can have control over trade policy. It's not just Donald Trump who's running the show. You have control over it. Like the reason the TPP wasn't ratified is because Congress refused to do it because it would give credit to Obama. Like, so Congress has power to help Trump with this. The reason they won't do it is because they don't want to criticize a Republican president. So even though like the economy could crash over this, even though he is ruining farmers who voted for him, but he's also ruining the lives of consumers whose prices are going up, like the prices of TVs, cars, et cetera, anything that uses steel or aluminum is going up to every single consumer in the United States, because we are now being forced, like manufacturers are now being forced to buy American goods, which are not going to cost more.
Yeah, so it goes back to Republican senators making sad speeches and sad tweets and then actually doing fucking nothing, because that's exactly what they do.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, also, like you said, you know, not playing by the rules with the World Trade Center and doing so blatantly. I mean, that's kind of Trump's signature move. That's the mark of authoritarianism, where you flout the rules and you do so gleefully. So he's just now moving that pattern to a global stage.
It doesn't make sense for Donald Trump, who is an international businessman, who conducts international business, to be like against
international man of business,
to be against multilateral organizations. I really don't understand it, right? Because multilateral trade organizations help him, not just help him, but help the rich people he wants to be friends with, right? So like it helps people. Like he tweeted an anti-Semitic slur, but he also tweeted like an attack on the Koch brothers recently. But he tweeted, you know, my policies are making the Koch brothers richer. Yeah, they are, man. Your tax cut was really good for them. But also, if you fix your stupid trade policy, you'd make them even richer and they'd make you president again, right? So there's no self-interest associated with it. It's truly the fact that he has ideas about trade that don't make sense in the 21st century. They basically never made sense, but they really don't make sense in the 21st century, especially because he's not even doing a good job targeting China. So that's tariffs for you. They don't make sense, and the response to them also is not great. Okay, Devin, who's our hellion for the week?
So we actually have two, and the first one is LeBron James. So first of all, LeBron James is coming to the Lakers because LA is the best. Everyone else sucks. I'm just kidding, of course, but I'm a big Lakers fan, so I'm very excited about this. But he is opening a school called I Promise, and it is basically a whole child system to create opportunities for children that wouldn't normally have them. So basically the exact opposite of what Trump and Sessions are doing. He wants to create a program that not only educates kids, but also gives them a bike because, you know, he said that when he was a kid, his bike kept him out of trouble. He was able to get around and get out. It will have resources for the parents, job training, food banks, meal planning, basically looking at the whole problem of education and solving it. So basically what our government should be doing, but it takes a basketball star to do it. So fuck you, Betsy DeVos.
She is literally one of the worst secretaries of education, I think, in our U.S. history.
Like my personal fucking nemesis.
Yeah.
And LeBron James, you know, I was listening to Nicole Wallace, whom I love, and I really liked how she put this. She was like, LeBron James not only is doing this great work, and Laura Ingraham, who, by the way, was like, you know,
shut up and dribble.
LeBron James should shut up and dribble. Okay, first of all, basically in much more polite language, fuck you, Laura Ingraham. But then she was like, you know, LeBron James is such a fascinating foil to Trump because he's everything that Trump wants to be. He's richer than Trump. He's more famous than Trump. He's more well-liked than Trump. He's got more celebrity friends than Trump. And Trump can't fucking hurt him because with the NBA or the NFL protests and Colin Kaepernick taking a knee and Trump calling them literal sons of bitches, and then the NFL cave. But the NBA is behind LeBron here. There's nothing that Trump can do. You know, Trump likes going after young black men. That's his favorite demographic to target. But he can't touch LeBron James. And so it makes this not only an amazing act of humanitarianism, stepping in where our government is stepping back, but it also is standing up to Trump in a very unique way, saying, I'm better than you. And there's nothing you can do about it.
It's really amazing. I really, really, I love that this is not a charter school. It's not a private school. It's a public school.
Right.
And it's going to help. It's going to be like, there's no tuition. There's no cost. He's not just giving them like bikes. He's also providing them with laptops. He's also really helping these teachers. And like, these are going to be like some of the best teachers. They're going to have like a non-traditional school year and a longer school day. And so he's really innovating here. And it's something that every school should do if we actually invested in public education. And I think it's amazing. It's really inspiring to see him like give back to his community and to really understand that not only are these kids, like, do these kids deserve a chance, but I can provide that to them. It's not something that I just have to like rely on the government to do. I can step up and do it.
Right.
And also, like, the most right. important thing is if these kids graduate, right, and if they do well, they have paid tuition to the University of Akron. So he's really yeah. developing community in Akron that supports education, that supports these kids, and it's amazing. It's truly inspiring.
It is. It honestly was one of my favorite stories of the week. The other hellion is Kirsten Gillibrand.
Yeah.
Kirsten Gillibrand is actually wonderful, but she stood up to George Soros, who is basically giving her shit about taking a stand against Al Franken and the sexual abuse and pushing him out of the Senate. She was not having any of it and basically said, if you don't support...
If standing up for women who have been wronged makes George Soros mad, that's on him. That is what she said. It is so badass. She was just like...
It is so badass.
I think what like would have been expected of any other politician would have been like, I did what I did. Or she would have been like, every single person in the Democratic caucus eventually supported this. It wasn't just me. Like, she would have like tried to pass it on. But proof that she really cares about sexual assault victims, that she really cares about accountability in her party, is that she took responsibility for it. Because even though right. it wasn't just her, she encouraged the female members of the Senate in her caucus in the Democratic Party to encourage Al Franken to resign. But it wasn't just her. It was her. It was Mazie Hirono, Kamala Harris. A bunch of people came together and told Al Franken, you got to go, man. And then we got an amazing yeah. senator out of it, Tina Smith. So this bullshit that yeah. is just Kirsten Gillibrand's fault is so pathetic. But the reason that she had to, you know, punch back at Soros is because Soros and a bunch of other Democratic donors are just like, I'm not going to support Gillibrand anymore for re-election or for 2020. And I'm just like, I don't care. Don't give any money to the Democratic Party. I don't give a fuck. Like, I tweeted this last right. night, and obviously the DNC doesn't listen to me, but if they did, they would retweet my tweet and support it. I tweeted, any Democratic donor who refuses to donate to Gillibrand just because of her stance on sexual assault and Franken resigning, is a donor that the Democratic Party need not accept money from. I don't care if we lose billions of dollars. It is so true. We don't need money from those kind of people, because that's the type of...
We really don't.
Like, you know when Democratic Socialists or people on the far left complain about corporate donations? Corporate donations are bad. It's not because the politician is inherently going to make bad decisions when it comes to financial reform. It gives a bad perception, right?
It also gives way more free speech to corporations than to people. So that's...
Exactly.
That's a whole other conversation for another
day.
Yeah,
and so like I support them when they say that. There are no like exceptions to that. I support them. But this type of speech, right? This type of donation where you are saying, I'm only going to donate to you because you didn't support Al Franken resigning, or you don't have this intense need to hold your own party accountable for sexual assault. Like, you know when to have someone's back. That's another type of donation that's compromised and should not be accepted. And so I think it's amazing that Gillibrand like stood up for herself and her view on sexual assault and her view for holding her own party accountable.
This goes to the heart of the misogyny of our own party, because they are coming after women who look like will be nominated in 2020, because it's the same narrative over and over and over. I was reading this great article about how people don't assume that they deserve their Senate seats. Men deserve their Senate seats inherently and have a right to them. And women have to prove that they're allowed to be there. And if they're ambitious, they're labeled as bitches. And if they're tough, they're labeled as hard asses and unlikable and inauthentic or too emotional or too vulnerable. Says the guy who tweets from the toilet at one in the morning. But there's this idea, it's never about the person. It's about the fact that a powerful woman scares men. And the idea that she is somehow unqualified to run for president because...
She stood up for something,
Because she stood up for something, which is what we want our presidential candidates to be, is ludicrous.
Yeah.
It's absolutely about the fact that she is a woman, and she is a woman that... has a real shot at being nominated in 2020.
Yeah.
It's going to be the same fucking like highlight reel as it was with Hillary Clinton. Maybe it won't be about emails, but it'll be like, oh, Kirsten Gillibrand's a flip-flopper. She's not. Oh, she's such a bitch. She's not. But it all comes down to the same thing. She's too ambitious and she doesn't know her place.
Yeah. And I just want to say it also goes to like, you know, this ambitious line, this line that she's too calculating or ambitious. We don't talk about this when men are doing this, right? So like when Bernie Sanders supports Medicare for all, everyone in the media is like, oh my God, what a leftist hero. And everyone gets super excited. But when Kirsten Gillibrand came out for abolishing ICE before Bernie Sanders,
right?
She was literally like, people on the New York Times staff were tweeting, oh, maybe her language is really calculating. Her tweet was different than what she said on CNN. Like, maybe this is just her way to like clinch the nomination. No, she lives in New York. She is no longer a congressperson from upstate New York. She's now the senator of all of New York. And she has realized that her constituents don't support the human rights abusers who work at ICE. And so she realized, this is what my constituents want, but also this is what I believe in. And she has tapped into like the actual democratic value that we have developed over the past few years, which is immigration is good and we shouldn't throw kids in baby jails. It's not that hard of a value to tap into. And so like, yeah, you can call her ambitious, you can call her calculating, but every fucking man has done that in the history of fucking politics. Like my paper on Teddy Roosevelt, right? It's about how he like championed conservatism to really, really bolster like his executive power in the branch and to take power away from Congress. Yes, he believed in conservation, but he also really liked power. It was really ambitious and calculating. Every male politician in the history of the world has been ambitious and calculating. That's why they're politicians. So of course she's going to be like that, but obviously it's sexist. And it also happens not just with Kirsten Gillibrand, but Stacey Abrams too, right? So Stacey Abrams got an amazing Times article, right? But the tweet and the lead into the Times article was how an unlikely candidate got to become the Democratic nominee for the governor of Georgia.
She's not. She's the Democratic base in one person. And she's eminently qualified.
She's highly educated. She's a Rhodes Scholar. Like, she's amazing.
Yeah, she's not unlikely. She's the most likely person. And so it's not just Stacey Abrams or Kirsten Gillibrand. It's also Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris and Hillary Clinton And this narrative that women who are ambitious or strong or smart are bitches or mean or calculating or inauthentic, it all comes back to the same principle that women need to learn their place. And we need to push back against that. And so, Kirsten Gillibrand, you are a true hellion. Our guest today is Marissa Cabus, writer and editorial director for CrushTheMidterms.org, a platform designed to create customized action plans in the run-up to the midterm elections. So, Marissa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, it's been a while. You're just saying that I talked to you back in January.
Has it been that long?
Yeah, it has been. Can you tell us about Crush the Midterms? So where did the idea come from and what has been the process of getting that up and running been like?
So the team and I had been thinking about what was the best thing we could do to help prepare for the midterms. And it sort of goes back to an idea we had earlier of these new activists coming out of 2016 that really wanted to help out, but they didn't know what to do. And we were thinking people need a step-by-step way to see what they can do and where they can be the most effective. But how could we get that sort of mechanism to the masses very easily? And thus, Crush for Midterms was born. And it's a super easy to use tool. It kind of functions almost like a quiz, like you're taking a fun BuzzFeed quiz or something. I mean, you've used it. Mm-hmm. Tell me if you agree. And users just answer a few basic questions about where they live and their interests and how much time they have to donate and volunteer. And we create a customized plan just for them. So it's not like they're just, you know, reading some random article. We're literally telling them, here's what to do, here's when to do it, and this is how you're going to actually make an impact on the outcome of the elections.
Yeah, it was so easy to use. Like you said, it did really feel like a quiz, where it just asked you some like really basic questions and really gave you a lot of information based on your answers, which was very helpful. So last time we spoke, we were actually talking about another project that you were on, which was HOPE, which was connecting the news with activism. So do these two projects relate? And was Crush the Midterms born out of that?
Yeah, so we kind of see Crush the Midterms as a spinoff of HOPE. HOPE's really focused on what's happening today or maybe in the immediate future. And we see Crush the Midterms as an extension of the philosophy behind HOPE. So it's not just looking out a day or a week, but looking out at this point, 97 days, and beyond that, because we're thinking about the implications of the outcome of the midterm elections. So how can we take our regular lives, which are busy, and people are parents and students and have full-time jobs and you know, things to deal with, health issues, and so how can we help incorporate this activism and volunteerism into their life? Because we all know what's at stake, and no one wants to feel like on November 7th that they didn't make the contribution that they wish they had. And it's also understanding that everyone can't make the same level of contribution. Not everyone has that bandwidth. So by taking the Crush the Midterms quiz, as we're calling it, you're setting the parameters. We're not making you give more time or more money than you're able to. Right. So if you are overwhelmed by your own plan, there's nothing stopping you from going back and readjusting for what feels comfortable for you. But it's so much about it is accountability.
Right.
And making a plan, when you have a plan for anything, for how you're going to study for a test or how you're going to prepare for an interview or, you know, plan a party, there's something about having it in writing out in front of you mapped out that helps you see the bigger picture, that helps you see the finish line and really want to accomplish things to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. Because something like the midterms can feel very overwhelming, there are multiple things for you to vote for on each ballot that are very personal down to, you know, who your district rep is. And it can be very overwhelming. And so I feel like that personalization is really important. What I also loved is that it asked the person taking the quiz about skills or interests that you have and connected you to specific organizations that can use those skills. So do you think that makes it easier to follow a plan like this?
I think so. So much of politics is personal. A lot of times people get involved with politics in the first place because they are personally affected by a tragedy or by some policy decision that personally impacts them or their family. So for example, gun violence or criminal justice reform or racial justice. So by giving people the option of connecting directly with an issue that matters most to them, it's a really easy way in. So they can say, I'm helping win the midterms for progressive and democratic candidates, but I'm also helping to reach this sort of goal for an issue I care about. So tighter gun control or prison reform or what have you.
So you're also focusing on the candidates, which is obviously very important. But what about things on a state-to-state basis that might be on the ballot otherwise? Is that something maybe you're looking to add, or are we just focusing on candidates?
So funny, we were just talking about that today. There's so many important ballot measures right. that are going to be voted on. We were focusing on the candidates just because we find that that's the easiest thing to connect to sure. a name, a face. People see them in ad campaigns and social media, and there's name recognition. But as we've seen with so many different ballot measures, they're so important and they have far-reaching impacts. But that is something that we're talking about, and I believe will be the next phase of engagement in the, like I said, 97 days we have left.
I know. Yeah, I mean, ballot measures also tend to be boring as hell. Even for someone like me, I love politics, and like reading them, I'm like, oh, this is a slog.
Well, they're often so intricately worded
yes.
and follow and purposely misleading, I think, yeah. by design because of whichever party is writing them.
Right.
I mean, I remember I'm based in New York and there was a ballot measure last year, something about the environment, and I had to read it 5 times yeah. to understand what it was. My friend was asking me, as her like political friend,
right.
you know, I'm sure you get that a lot. Hey, do you read politics? Like, with this obscure ballot measure. And so I reread it 5 times and I'm like, I don't know yes or no.
Right.
Like, I'm genuinely confused. So I did a little research and then figured it out. But I mean, if I had to take that much time
right.
and I'm involved with politics, the average person who doesn't have time to read up on every ballot measure
right.
needs some sort of summary and a little bit of direction of how they should approach it at the polls.
Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of them use like triple negatives and you're just like, what?
Yeah.
What are we doing here? Yeah. I also really liked that, you know, you could also be connected by your skills. For example, like I have a skill set in coding. And so I put that in there and there were organizations specifically looking for someone who could like do a little bit of back end work on their website. And do you find that that is also a way to get people involved? Is that effective?
Yes, we definitely think so, because there's a lot of anxiety around making cold phone calls,
yeah.
especially knocking on doors. I've done canvassing before and I still have anxiety about it. You never know whose door you're knocking on.
Right.
You have a name and you know how they voted in the past maybe or their party affiliation, but you just never know who's going to be on the other side of that door. So I get that, but we're trying to make the point that no matter what your skill set is, there is a way that you can make an impact. So for example, if you are not into crowds, if you're not, you know, super social or you're not mobile and unable to leave the house, there's this great thing called postcards to voters.
Mm.
And we've found that so many people are engaging with that tool where we've been suggesting it, and people love it because it's something you can do whenever you have time. You don't have to be mindful of anyone else's schedule. Like, is it too late to call? Is it too
right.
late to knock? And you can just sort of sit down at your kitchen table and write out some postcards. And there's also this very personal connection. It's like your handwriting going to someone else, another voter in the country, and that could have a real impact on how someone votes.
Yeah. I know. People are always surprised to find out that I hate canvassing. I mean, I talk for a living. And so people are always like, you hate it? And I'm like, yeah, because I get weird anxiety about knocking on random people's doors. I feel like that's totally normal.
Well, it's like doing improv.
Yeah, exactly. I'm terrible at improv, too. Like, I'm not funny. So, you know.
And then if you're reading too closely to the script,
yeah.
very stiff and unnatural, and no matter how you slice it, it's invasive knocking on someone's
right.
door.
Right, exactly. So yeah, I do love that there's other ways for people to get involved that don't involve that sort of direct action. You know, you have other ways to do it. I also found it super interesting that I asked you if you have connections to other states or other parts of the country. So, like, I have family in Michigan, and so there was an action plan for getting in touch with people there. Do you think that's an important part of this process? Because I know there's a lot of talk about, like, don't call senators that aren't your representative, like, don't reach out in other states. So do you think that that is also but an effective tool?
Our team thinks it's a crucial part of the tool because there are so many people who live in these liberal centers. For example, my district in Brooklyn, New York, New York's 8th congressional district. My rep, Hakeem Jeffries, is running unopposed.
Yeah.
And so it would be really easy for someone like me to say, there's nothing I can do in my district. I mean, it's locked in. It's like the most liberal district in the country. What could I possibly do? Now, I may not be a great example because my family is also from a very liberal area. But the point is, if you're in one of these centers, you can make a difference in your hometown or where you went to college. We offer different options for your network. So there's a little drop-down menu that says, I went to school here, I have family here, or maybe you just have coworkers in another state. So extending this tool to them and saying, I think this could be really helpful to you, is just a really great way to go outside of your immediate bubble and feel connected to voters in the rest of the country, especially in places like Michigan, yeah. which is huge
yeah,
this year.
Exactly. Yeah. I know. I always joke because my local rep for Congress is Brad Sherman, who was one of the two people who put forth articles of impeachment against Trump. I'm like, yeah, like you do you, Brad Sherman. So, and you mentioned network a lot, and leveraging your network, which I think is so important in this age of social media, is using that social network, especially if you live in sort of liberal areas, does leveraging your network still make an impact?
I think so. I think that this isn't really based on anything scientific, but I think that anecdotally, if you live in a more conservative area, but you are very progressive, if you're posting things on social media, I've heard of people getting messages like, hey, I'm also feeling that way. I don't like the way things are now. I don't support the president. I don't support our congressperson. What can I do?
Right.
And then you see these massive networks grown in places where you never would have imagined there being Democrats. Right. I mean, you look at Moms Demand Action, who advocate for gun changes in the laws, and they have groups absolutely everywhere.
Yeah.
And how did those moms connect to each other? How did they know that, like, that mom at carpool, she actually doesn't like what's going on right now? Right. She thinks guns are a scourge on this country.
Right.
And so putting it out there on social media is sort of like sending up a flare. Mm. It's like, hey, I'm here, you can see me, and if you're like-minded, we can connect.
Right. Yeah, that community building, that's so important to this sort of thing. Kind of on that vein, though, there's been a lot of talk, you know, it's been 18, 19 months since Trump was elected. There's a lot going on. There's a deluge of bullshit every day. And there's a lot of talk about fatigue. You know, I know that part of this project is getting people energized and getting people mobilized. Have you seen issues breaking through that sort of fatigue?
Yes and no. I think as far as getting coverage for our launch, it was pretty difficult because the news networks and the people who are writing about this stuff day in and day out, it's sort of hard to talk about this midterm election planning thing when there's Russian news breaking every day, right. And yeah, there's Michael Cohen tapes and there's like all this craziness that I'm not going to say it's not important because I think it is part of history in the making, but it's really, it can be hard for people to see the forest through the trees.
Right.
And I think that is the crucial part of our work. We are saying, we know things are so crazy right now, but we want things to be less crazy in the future. And that's why we really need to crush the midterms. We need to win this thing, and we need to take action now and not a couple of days before.
Right.
Like, we really need to set this in motion. And it's cool because, you know, we have a Twitter account for Crush the Midterms. It's at Crush 18 Midterms. And we exclusively talk about midterm stuff. So about the candidates and about ballot measures and about polling. So if that's what you want, that's what we're giving you. We're not talking about the extraneous stuff. Whereas if you're following Politico or NBC News or any of the big outlets. It's everything. So you kind of have to comb through it to get to what you want to see.
Yeah.
But we are really having this laser focus on the midterm elections, and it can be hard to kind of put the other stuff away, but we're encouraging people to maybe put certain things on the back burner and really focus on this end goal.
Yeah, I mean, because 97 days isn't a lot. I mean, it's so funny because it sounds both kind of far away and also like, oh shit, this is in 5 minutes. You know,
yeah.
Like it feels at the same time, like very close and far. So, and I do feel like though, you know, 100 days, 97 days is enough time where it's not overwhelming to start taking steps. I feel like it's a good time. So what is the most important thing for people to keep in mind in the run up to the midterms?
I think it's important for them to keep in mind that they can make a real impact. I think it can feel like they're just one person in this giant country of millions of people, and the federal government's running rampant and their reps are not representing their district's interests. But you never know who you're going to connect with when you're doing this kind of work. And you never know what kind of influence that person has. There really is a sort of domino effect of getting people involved. And when people see you out in your community making a difference, it's going to inspire them. And a big part of what we have encouraged people to do is when you fill out your plan, to share your plan, to say, not just say, hey, you should do this, say, I have done this. I am making a commitment because I have this goal in mind, and I would really invite you to do the same.
So what is one positive thing that you've seen come out of this project so far, or what's really energizing you personally in the run up to the midterms, which is in about 5 minutes?
Everyone will see that once you complete your plan, a little chat bubble pops up on the plan page. And it's from Josh, who is our wonderful team director. And now it has a different message, but at first it said, you know, what are you doing to crush the midterms and how can I help you? So we thought people would just submit bugs or something,
right,
with the team, or like issues that they were having. But we, in the first 24 hours, we already saw all these people just volunteering the stuff that they're already doing,
wow,
saying I'm the head of my local indivisible group, or I'm hosting a phone bank, or I collected signatures to get someone on the ballot. And they were just so proud to show us what they were doing.
Right.
It wasn't a showy thing because this was a private messaging.
Right.
Well, they had no idea who was on the other end. For all they knew, Josh wasn't a real person.
Right.
It was just like the name of the bot. Josh is a real person. But they just really wanted to share because they were so excited about the work they were doing. So that really showed me that there are good people out there,
yeah,
who have already begun doing the work even before making their Crush the Midterms plan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's amazing. People always just amaze me when it comes to this kind of stuff. The energy and community building that I see, particularly like women and people of color executing, especially around these midterms, is absolutely mind-blowing. I've been blown away by it.
And even people who, there's one woman who told us that she was dealing with family illness and that it was hard for her to leave the house a lot, but how committed she was to making a difference. And it just made me think, if someone like her is able to put the country above personal needs from time to time, imagine what those of us who have less on our plate are able to do. And it's really, like I said, you may feel like one person, but it really is this collective movement, whether you want to call it a blue wave or you just want to call it a fight to save democracy.
Yeah. You know, that little old thing, democracy.
We all play a part.
Right. So what is one thing that our listeners can do while listening to this show? Not canvassing, not knocking, not nothing. Right now, what is something you could do? One thing.
Visit crushthemidterms.org and make a plan.
Okay. Love it. Love it.
Shameless plug.
Yeah, no, but it's true. Or like, you know, just something. Because sometimes it can be hard just to get started, right?
So. Yes. I think that making a Crush the Midterms plan would be great. It gives you all the info that you need on who you're going to be voting for. And we highlight the competitive races in your district,
right,
so you know which ones are really high stakes. But they're all important, and knowing your representatives is always a good thing. Crush the midterms.
Crush the midterms. Well, Marissa, thank you so much for joining me today. You can follow Marissa at Marissa Cabus, and you can follow Crush the Midterms at, like you said, Crush 18 Midterms, and then make your own plan at crushthemidterms.org. I did it. It took 4 seconds. It was so easy. And it energized me, like, because it can be sometimes be hard for me, and this is what I do, to like have a plan. And sometimes you can feel a little lost. So it really helped.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you. Yeah. See you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Varsha, thank you so much for joining us on a Thursday. That was a really great conversation. And thank you for explaining tariffs so beautifully.
It was a lot of fun. And thank you for dealing with Birth of a Nation. I look forward to, or Death of a Nation. I look forward to reading your write-up on that.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Hellions, that is it for us. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Marissa as much as I did. Like I said, she's so smart and she's so great. And use Crush the Midterms. It is a helpful tool. It will keep you accountable. I used it. I love it. And have a great weekend. And until I see you next time, raise some hell and remember to be more compassionate.